Welcome into another special edition of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler, and today is Monday, August 30th. For the final installment of our three-part DLBCL series, we'll hear from Dr. Jill Sals, Chief of the Lymphoma Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and Dr. Cami Maddox, an Associate Professor of Clinical Internal Medicine in the Division of Hematology at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. I asked these experts about their thoughts on data from the L-MIND trial, when to really implement CAR T-cell therapies for patients with DLBCL, the role of selinexor in treating patients, and a host of other important ideas.
With that three-year update, what do you think the implications are for that research for treating these patients? And do you genuinely believe that, you know, tafasitamab can be a viable treatment option for patients in the second-line setting?
Well, I definitely think that for patients that are not transplant eligible, and especially for patients that are in the relapse setting, tafasitamab lenalidomide is really a good option to be tried. There is a concern by some physicians regarding the fact that with tafasitamab, we target the CD19 antigen, which is also the antigen that is targeted by CAR T-cell. There may be a masking of the antigen by the use of the antibody, but after a washout period of 4 to 6 weeks, which usually correspond to the time of assessing the eligibility for CAR T, leukapheresis of the cell manufacturing and things like that, could be washed out. So we don't have strong data supporting the fact that it's safe to administer CAR T after tafasitamab and lenalidomide, but I don't think we have either strong data supporting that it's not effective. And we have anecdotal report that it worked in some patients. So I think this is an area of investigation.
What was one or two of the main key takeaways from that L-MIND trial that really stood out to you, that really kind of signaled it will be an alternative treatment option?
So when you, the trial was designed to look at patients who are not eligible for transplant and have received a median of 1 to 3 prior therapies. Right. And it did exclude patients who were, primary refractory to treatment. However, when you looked at the results, there was a 60% overall response rate with 40% of patients achieving a complete response, which, you know, is pretty impressive in a cohort of patients, again, that, their other options were all options that were going to be less than that and going to be for a palliative approach. I think personally, the most intriguing thing about the data is the follow-up data that show in the median median duration of response. So in those patients who do achieve a CR, the median duration of response in these patients has been shown to be over 4 years with longer follow, or close to 4 years, over 40 months with longer follow-up. And so that's, you know, pretty impressive to be able to show those remissions are durable. Because it, you know, in large cell lymphoma, we often think if somebody hasn't, we look at the 2-year mark and whether initial therapy or relapse therapy, if somebody is maintaining their remission at 2 years, that's very promising that they may be able to achieve a long-term progression-free survival with that therapy.
What are there any common characteristics for patients who receive CAR Ts? You know, what do you see with a patient when you decide that CAR T cell therapies will be a viable option? And specifically, we can focus on axi-cel, liso-cel, and tiso-cel. Is there anything that stands out with a patient that kind of triggers to you that this might be a good option for them?
I mean, any patient that you consider a candidate for transplant, but they don't respond to treat their salvage treatment, to me, you know, or they relapse after a transplant, that's a candidate for CAR T. I think the harder population is those patients that you don't really think are a candidate for transplant, but CAR T is not approved as a second line therapy. So you're thinking really, what do I give them in second line? And are they going to be a future candidate for CAR T cell therapy? In my practice, typically, I think whether or not they're a candidate for CAR T cell therapy, if I give them something now that works, maybe they won't need CAR T cell therapy. So I'm not necessarily treating them or avoiding any certain agents, thinking in the future that might be an option. I'm treating them now to get their disease under control. And if it progresses after second line therapy, then I'm looking at just, you know, are they somebody that, you know, that seems like they'll be able to tolerate. Again, the ability to tolerate CAR T cells seems to be much broader or a much bigger population than patients who can get an autologous stem cell transplant. So there's reports of, you know, people in their 80s, maybe even early 90s receiving CAR T cell therapy. So age isn't so much a factor. I do think you have to think about, you know, the potential for things like the cytokine release and neurotoxicity, and just making sure that they can, you know, that's somebody that you predict can handle the toxicities of the treatment if they arise.
So you mentioned that CAR Ts weren't approved in the second line setting. Just to follow up with that, is there any research or data that you've seen that would kind of, you know, bring it to a point where that could be a viable option in the second line?
Yeah, I mean, so we know there's been three randomized controlled trials evaluating patients that are considered high risk, so relapse or refractory to initial therapy, or relapse prior to 1 year of after completion of therapy, randomizing to them to standard of care of chemo and transplant versus a CAR T cell product. And two of those have, you know, at least made announcements that their data has shown improvements in event-free survival in the population of patients who went to CAR T. So I think that we're probably, you know, there's very high potential that could be approved in the future in those patients in the second line setting. Now, whether, you know, you'll see an approval broadly across the board or whether it'll be restricted to certain population of patients, I guess, is something I'm not sure of. There was data presented previously last year showing patients who were not candidates for transplant, but were considered candidates for CAR T, and it was just a small number of patients, but they were older patients that were treated with CAR T in the second line setting that showed, you know, that was potentially safe and efficacious. So I do think that, you know, as we get more data and as these trials, you know, we get more data from them and they're reported out with full results, that there is a high likelihood that this will be a potential option, at least for some patients at initial relapse.
And so you mentioned this briefly about a patient needs to wait about 4 to 6 weeks to be able to be treated. And I'm curious about some of those other common characteristics. Do you see anything else across patients that would really trigger to you that CAR T is a viable option, or is this really taken by a patient by patient basis?
No, as I said, you have to have a disease that is not exploding with a rapid growth of the tumor, a high LDH, 3-5 times normal, 10 times normal. You know that these patients are unlikely to have a sustained benefit. Some have some, but right now we probably need to improve for those patients. For the patient who have a disease with a reasonable tumor burden, with normal or subnormal LDH, this is clearly a very favorable option. And we have learned from recent presentation in meetings, and we are waiting for the publication, that patients that achieve a CR with this product can really have a long-term benefit and are potentially cured after 4 or 5 years. So it's really an important option for this patient. But again, those patients with more aggressive, more invasive disease or rapidly evolutive disease are more prone to present side effects and have a little bit less benefit from this CAR T therapy.
And so you kind of, throughout your response, I think you've kind of alluded to this really important idea of patient selection and what treatments will be best for patients. So could you walk me through really kind of the process of selecting patients for some of these therapies and some of the important factors that you and other professionals really consider when trying to decide which treatment option a patient will receive?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, some of this is almost like protocolized, but in a lot of ways, it's really dependent on the patient that you're treating. And you have to think of the individual patient, you know, not just their age, their comorbidities, their particular situation, their family situation, there's, you know, their access to different treatment centers. So a lot goes into it. But it, you know, in general, when somebody comes to me with relapse refractory disease, my first, you know, decision is this a patient that's eligible for transplant or not? And I base that on how do they tolerate their initial therapy? What are their comorbidities? Do I think they can withstand a transplant? Heart function, lung function, kidney function. And then you go down the pathway because that is potentially curable if that's the case. If they're not a candidate for that, while the L-MIND trial did exclude primary refractory patients, as you know discussed, I do think that there's a benefit to thinking about something other than chemotherapy, and that is probably my preferred option in those patients. To try to use that treatment approach. I have considered in some patients BR-POLA, maybe if I need quick access to something. As far as patients who do not achieve a remission to transplant, then I'm thinking of chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapy, product dependent on, you know, patient's disease, age characteristics. In a patient who, say, relapses or doesn't respond to tafalen, in a patient who you have to bridge from a salvage they didn't respond to CAR T, that's when I'm thinking about some of the other agents like the loncastuximab, which is now approved, the BR-POLA, although, you know, some concerns about timing of bendamustine-based therapy and collection of CAR T cells. And then in patients who progress after CAR T cells, and again, are not a candidate or for a clinical trial, that's when I'm thinking about, you know, is Lonca. I have tried tafalen in this situation too. You know, maybe selinexor.
Another thing that really comes to mind, and I was hoping you could expand on this, is using selinexor. Could you talk to me about the specific situations where selinexor is probably the preferred treatment for patients ineligible for transplant?
So selinexor, I don't know that I would say in my practice, I see a lot of preferred areas for this, but the trial on selinexor, so its approval is in two or more prior therapies. The trial really enrolled a population of patients who had relatively non-aggressive disease, I would say. I mean, the patients that were enrolled on that trial had to go several weeks without having received prior therapy. And the overall response was close to about 30%, although there was a very small population who had durable responses. So based on the other agents that are approved in this setting and the overall responses seen with those agents, I would say that I think of selinexor as being more reserved for patients who are either not eligible for those other options, either due to the fact that they had those other options or they have toxicities from other treatments that they're not candidates for those options, or that it's not available for them, and who are not candidates for a clinical trial. Some of these might be older patients who are not candidates for clinical trial, not candidates for the other therapies. Some might be, I think, post-CAR T progression is a very difficult population to treat, and often these patients have seen several therapies, and that may be an option. Of course, the one benefit, but the benefit of selinexor is it's an oral therapy, so it's easier to administer for some patients than having to come in for infusions.
Right. And as I understand it, selinexor kind of has a unique mechanism of action compared to other agents. Could you talk a little bit about that and how it's administered exactly?
Yes. Well, selinexor is inhibiting a protein which is called XPO1, which is a nuclear export. So it exports a couple of protein from the nucleus, and it acts on major pathway basically, the drug block the export and then the availability of protein, which are important in oncogenesis, such as TP53 and other compounds. It's an oral agent. It can be administered twice a week or once a week at different doses. I can tell you, I don't have that on the top of my head, but we can resume that by text if you want later. And basically, again, you have to potentially adapt dosage based on the side effect, either the thrombocytopenia or the fatigue and GI symptoms.
And that aligns with the NCCN guidelines, which I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because it obviously has its preferred regimens in the second line setting, including rituximab plus gemcitabine and oxaliplatin. Are you using these preferred regimens frequently, or do you find yourself using other combinations?
So I think we have some chemotherapy regimen in second line that are in non-transplant eligible patients have, I would say, limited efficacy. So The R-GEMOX regimen with combination of rituximab, gemcitabine, oxaliplatin had given viable result in viable settings, but in patients that were previously exposed to rituximab and had failed R-CHOP, the median PFS never exceeds 6 months and is usually more like 4 months or even maybe less in our institution. So I think it's a regimen with limited efficacy. When we look at the bendamustine in rituximab, again, the results are very disappointing. It's a median PFS of 2 months in the pivotal trial of BR versus BR Pola, and I think this is in line with the real life data of this compound. So you can also use limited doses of RICE or DHACs, but these are more intensive regimen, RGDP. This is feasible also in some patients, although it's not the current regimen in non-transplant eligible patients. So I think we should really consider using the new agents in the setting of second line when they're approved, when they're available, and consider what are the paths the patient will go, whether it's a patient in which we want to treat the disease, stabilize, and potentially offer these new regimens and these new compounds for a sustained response, as we have seen with tafalen and potentially with Bia Pola, or whether this is a temporary time, and we know that after 2, 3, 4, 6 months, we may consider that the patient will have to go to CAR T therapy in the third line setting. So that's a discussion on patient per patient basis. But again, given the result of RGMOX or BR in second line, I will really encourage to consider in patients either BR Pola or Tafalen as an alternative option for these patients.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. And make sure to go back and check out the two previous episodes of this three-part series where we really go in depth on these topics and a ton more in relapse refractory DLBCL. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you again next time.